fucking outside for the world to see. Do you know who I am? The vision of this woman for me tripled in some mad hallucination for a second until I shook my head and blinked 3 times, swallowing reality. I couldn't think of anything to say in response, except one thing. "Where's your ball gown?" She squished her face to show complete confusion, turned her head slow to the boarded window and then back, sort of like a possessed doll in a horror film. No, not sort of. Exactly like that. "My what?" she said, keeping her hands limp on her sheets, which is something I began to focus on, for her lack of body movement became a blazing truth. Her arms didn't twitch. They hung dead to her sides. Only her head pivoted and her eyes bugged. "You wore a navy and blue ball gown out on the rocks 2 years ago. Where is it?" I suppose this crazy question was my attempt to jump the need to scour the joint for hard evidence, so as to obtain a direct confession that this woman was indeed the woman on the rocks in a ball gown. She laughed, a throaty, scratched record laugh, as of a sputtering engine coming to life. I stared at her, didn't blink. I wanted an answer. That's all I could do, mentally and physically, for I couldn't move my own limbs. Her real paralysis became mine. A dress? Blue dress. Oh yeah, I suppose blue. Right, blue. She said in a dead monotone, apathetic and weighted. Although I could have regarded this answer with suspicion, as if I had given her some talented Mr. Ripley clues for her to seize and falsely claim, I took it as a direct confession. She was indeed the woman on the rocks, in a ball gown 2 years ago, the night my mother launched herself into the ocean. I wanted to jump to another confession. Forcing myself out of shock and fear, I leaned over her and into her dry, bloated face. I grabbed my mother's orange beach glass necklace in a death grip and pulled, yanking it off her thickened neck. "Did you start the fire? Did you kill my mother? How did you get her necklace?" She laughed again, but stalled in her physical limpness, low-lidding me in a glare. The veins in her neck swelled with an effort to move her own arms, which twitched only as if in a slight seizure. She couldn't move, which I could tell angered her, or so it seemed. Her growling remained, as if she were a bloodthirsty puma in a jungle tree, waiting for her prey to step on the right spot. "Your mother's necklace? Oh, right. You're the bitch's niece. Right. So your mother must be Johanna Vandenbeer. You are just another fucking Vandenbeer." She pivoted her eyes to look at the boarded window again. This action told me she had 2 positions, staring out the boarded window and staring at me opposite the window. But was this truth or duplicity? Tricking me about her physical abilities? Perhaps wanting me to think her weak, so I would let my guard down? Her neck veins deflated and swelled to ropes. Deflated and swelled to ropes in an apparent effort to work her own muscles. I wondered how long she'd been at these attempts. I wondered what was true. I still wonder what is true. "Did you kill my mother?" I screamed in her face. Spit fled my furious mouth and landed in her dry brush hair. I could have lit her on fire with the tiniest spark if I wanted. And I wanted. I scanned the room for matches. Found none. With the apparent effort of a Mack truck shifting to some non-existent 8th gear to drive vertically up a building, she ratcheted her horror doll head 2 notches to meet my face again. A zigzag stitch line marked her forehead, something I hadn't focused on before, given the shock of finding her, No other sounds in the world existed except her wheezy breathing and the undercurrent of her constant personal physical therapy. Even the lights in the side room, which might have hummed. Even the monitors, which might have offered the white noise of beeping. Even the drip of some liquid into her veins ceased. We were well encased in a bubble of near soundless insanity, as if her mind and my mind had unfolded, turned inside out, and lay open to the physical realm of the room. The question on the table, in the air, fighting against her play of paralysis, beating me to face and grab hold of emergence, to try to climb out of the well once again, was whether this woman killed my mother. She glared at me, and her nose gnarled. Did you kill my mother? My aunt says you are her friend. She says you had an affair with a married man, and the wife put you in a coma. She poofed out a displeasure and rolled her buggy eyes, which, had they not been bugged and unblinking, would have been swallowed into the bloating of her unnatural face. Your aunt has no friends. You know that. Please, yeah, I heard what your aunt told you. She's a fucking liar. I'm not an idiot. I hide from her, you know. She has no idea I'm awake now. She'd put me under again if she did. You are basically my only fucking shot to get out of here. You're going to help me. But I know you won't unlock this chain without proof. Why don't you go and look in your aunt's wine cellar behind her fake bookcase to see what kind of woman she is? I backed away, stumbled into the cabinet once again, shaking it with my force and causing a metal scraping to reverberate around the room. The sounds of the monitor and the drip, so too the humming of the lights, returned. How does she know about the fake bookcase? I didn't wait for her to say more. Still clutching my mother's orange beach glass necklace, I ran out of the barn and headed to Auntie's house, pregnant with unanswered questions. What's in the attic? What's in the basement? I still had the front door key from the week before, so I entered Auntie's house. I suppose I could have retrieved all the house keys for all the inner rooms from the birdhouse out back, but I wasn't ready for everything yet. Off the marble foyer is a door to wooden stairs, which lead to a limestone and granite basement. I followed the way of natural substances, the marble to floor to limestone to granite, touching the sides of stone for pure truth, for what is truer than solid sand. As I reached Auntie's fake basement bookcase, I ignored the rumble of tires in the driveway. I pushed the right way on the hidden swivel lock, like I did to play hide-and-seek with Auntie 100 dozen times. It spun. And as it spun, I fell within the well of me, the cold slime of insanity's rocks scratching my shoulders in the descent. A scent of chalky dust and musty rocks pinched my inner nose. I fell to my knees on the real limestone, finding a new depth within which to fall. Out before me lay white bones in a fraying wool suit. A male skeleton. I looked up to the room's concrete ceiling, as if a higher sight might answer me. Tell me what I saw, whom these bones belonged to, and why I was here at all. My mouth hinged open, my eyes squinted in the darkness. On a nail on the inside of the door jamb, above my head, midway up the wall, hung a clipboard with a pen tied in twine to a hole in the top. A metal clamp trapped about an inch of papers, like a patient's records. Footsteps scattered the pebbles and seashells of Auntie's pebble and seashell driveway. And as I rose and backstepped out of the secret wine room to look down the basement hall and see out a basement window, I noted a black shadow had returned. Auntie's Audi. I had no time to hide, no time to think, no time for shock. I ripped the front page from the clipboard, shut the bookcase, ran up the basement stairs, and skidded as fast as possible into the mermaid library, so as to greet Auntie from the library and appear as though that's where I came from. As I slid, the door creaked open. I held my breath a couple of beats, hoping I'd hear no gasp from her, hoping to catch her off guard, coming in falseness from her library. "Where's my mother's necklace? Shit, I dropped my mother's necklace down there. She'll know. Auntie will figure it out. Relax, breathe. For now, get out of the house. And damn it, my journal, damn it. I left that on the cabinet in the side room with that woman. I'm toast. Auntie will know where I've been." Standing still in the library, I heard no gasp, nor did I hear her take any footsteps in the marble foyer, and I didn't hear her jangle her keys like she normally would. I swallowed a great bucket of air and wiped my brow while contemplating those strings of cobweb tears crying from the metal eyes of mermaid bookends. I stepped into the foyer, holding a book, pretending to be absorbed. "Ah," I yelled when I ran into her in the foyer. "Oh, you scared me. I came to grab a book I noticed last week." She gasped back. "How did you get in here?" she yelled, revealing a real anger, a disgust. She scanned one of her eyes up the front stairs. I didn't take the bait and follow her one-eyed gaze. I couldn't let on to my suspicions about the raccoon I was sure she lied about in the attic, nor my knowledge of her skeleton in the basement. I laughed, caving in my chest in a wince of apology. "Oh, I'm so sorry," I said, pretending I had no clue what angered her. I'd always been in and out of her house before, had my own keys before. "I took one of the door keys from under a mermaid last week." I handed the key back to her, to get her to drop her scowl. When I did, she snatched it fast. Another slap. Before, she would have laughed, accusing me of being off my rocker and to keep the damn thing, for I lived here too. How did I not shake in Auntie's presence when I met her in the foyer? How did I not cry or reveal my fright? How I stayed calm and emotionless, acting out the instant part I decided to play in her horror house, I don't know. Perhaps duplicity was multiple-folded by then. Mine to Manny, hers to me, hers to the world, mine to her, mine to myself, hers to herself. Duplicity had multiplied, folded, expanded, and grown into its own beauty, a rose garden universe of deceit, falseness itself, a pure truth. "I forgot my purse," she said in the coldest tone, jumping back as she snagged her black Valentino from a mirrored shelf in the foyer. I thought of the foyer mirror as reflecting the wicked witch who speaks the spell about Snow White. Auntie set a shaky hand on the newel post of the stairwell banister, as if blocking me from going up. Appraising her, I noted she'd changed into the crisp green sundress she'd always worn before. And her hair, still grayed, was now combed and clipped in a twist. She wore her eye patch. Perhaps this vision of a mostly old version of Auntie helped me to play out my beautiful duplicity and suppress before her the knowledge of her secret in the barn and her skeleton in the basement. "Yeah, I really wanted to get this book from the library," I said, thumbing backward to indicate the library. "Hope you don't mind." "Oh, Mop, I love when you take my books," she said in a phony happiness, as if the statement erased her crazy yelling about me taking her house key. And when she said this and smiled like the joy of her statement would make her cry, she was 100% the new Auntie acting out the part of the old Auntie. I could feel it, I could. A cavernous wish for love again, to forget everything I learned and remembered. But I stayed like stone. Holding the book so tight, I imagined the words squeezing out to fall and crack apart as letters on the marble floor.
"Well, since you're here, drive with me to Rye,"
Auntie said as a statement question.
"No,"
I said, edging around her for the second time in under an hour before she could pin me trapped in the library. I stood at the front door, one hand on the knob, the other holding the book.
"Manny's waiting for me. We'll meet you there,"
I said, not turning to tell her to her face. Racing toward Manny's, I chucked the book to a clearing in the brambles, intending to collect it later. Then I checked to confirm I still held the mistress note in my one back pocket, and in the other the quick-folded patient record I'd ripped from the hanging clipboard over the dead white bones of the secret in the basement.
My journal.
Well, damn it, my journal lay on the cabinet in the side room of the barn. My mother's orange necklace with the bones in the basement. I was cooked, the worst spy in the universe. But I was out, on my way to Manny's, and whatever Auntie intended to reveal at our house in Rye, well, I braced for that. On the one page of patient record I swiped from the basement, daily entries filled one line each, one for each day, all the same. Still dead.
Chapter 15. Mop.
1 week ago, the Rye Estate.
Auntie is keeping a skeleton in her basement.
A bloodless, fleshless corpse. She keeps a woman chained in her barn. And here we are on the Rye Estate's rooftop, eating brick oven pizzas from the domed oven installed up here, as if tonight's just another surreal summer night for people in mansions. This is what I thought a week ago. Someone from the kitchen staff poured me a deep goblet of Bordeaux.
"A margarita with spinach, please,"
I whispered to the chef, who molded pizza dough at the mouth of the fire-breathing hearth. The ocean tumbled below, in control of the white noise of our Rye home. The sunset blazed orange and purple over the navy Atlantic. No clouds cluttered the still bright summer dusk. My Bordeaux cooled my tongue, a smooth wash, like slow love, pressed against a building, an unhurried kiss of ownership in a mist after a rain. Auntie sat across from me at our rooftop tavern table, fidgeting with her linen napkin. She hadn't touched a drop of the perfect vintage, so I knew she fretted on how to broach her most unimaginable topic with me and my father, when and where. Amber candles suggested a coming calm of evening, but summer light shined on, despite the bruise blaze sunset. Aunt Sister Mary Patience sat beside me, my father at the end of the table, Manny to the right of him. The men were discussing a variety of typical matters, golf scores, hotel development, offshore accounts, the tragedy that no one paid attention to, a book titled The Panama Papers, charitable boards, the NASDAQ, whether tennis is better than racquetball, how to rid the Rye pool of a pesky resident bullfrog while giving said bullfrog a proper habitat elsewhere, and the awful presidential election cycle, and the falseness of the binary, media-created political system in America. Typical. Average. Regular old dinner topics in Rye. I tuned all of this out, and watched Auntie Liv fidgeting with her napkin and not engaging in any of the various topics. I also watched Aunt Sister Mary Patience watching, like she was logging Auntie's every micro-movement, and also logging my watching of Auntie Liv.
"Oh, hey, I found this cleaning out the coach house's furnace. I'm having it replaced, the furnace,"
Aunt Sister Mary said, digging in her housecoat pocket, fisting something, and reaching across the table to plunk the item in Auntie Liv's palm.
a round metal shirt pin.
Not sure how the pin got into the old furnace. Looks old. Was among some other odds and ends. A hair clip, pennies, a couple of marbles. Guys think it's stuff that fell through the floor vent on the first floor, and then they never removed the old furnace when they put in the old furnace. Well, anyway, we're redoing everything now, so found things rattling around down in the basement.
Auntie Liv's one eye turned to steel. She stopped fidgeting. Manny and my father noticed nothing, for their conversation had moved along with them. They left the table and walked, shoulder to shoulder, to the roof's edge, to point out possible locations to build the pool bullfrog, a man-made pond.
"You think you're so superior, don't you? Testing me like this? You think you can shake me with this pin and judge how I react?"
Auntie Liv snarled at Aunt Sister Mary, while squeezing the pin to her palm so tight her fingers turned white. The sudden shift from Auntie Liv's nervousness to viciousness upon the simple plunk of a metal pin in her hand was like walking down the street and being shot by a drive-by shooter. No warning, no reason, just instant violence.
"No, Lynette. No. I'm sorry. What? I just wanted to show you, ask you. I thought maybe you and Johanna might remember it from playing when you were girls. That's all. It's so distinctive, the green and the blue and the outline of California."
"Oh, sure," Auntie said, her voice low, her lip curling on one end. The kitchen girl with the Bordeaux flirted with the chef at the stove, not caring about our conversation. Manny and my father chuckled about the shape of a potted boxwood on the roof, which the gardener had sheared into the shape of an eyeball. Such dichotomy between their worlds and ours. Like three wholly separate dimensions on one roof. Three truths. I felt dizzy. Didn't know where to look, what to listen to. A fog formed, but I fought. I fought through.
"You want me to believe you never heard about what happened to me in that damn brick coach house you live in now? How dare you? As if Johanna never said anything to you, and how I mentioned this pin to the police. How he shoved it in my mouth and told me to bite it in my front teeth tight, or else I'd choke on it.
He wanted that little medal to keep me quiet while he violated me. And here you so casually and caustically plunk it in my hand for a reaction. You are wicked." I'd never seen Auntie Liv react so uncontrolled before. Nor had anyone ever mentioned to me what really happened to Auntie Liv in that coach house when she was young. She seemed willing to now air this impolitic, personal topic in a seething hatred, open and free, as if she'd been waiting for any alternative topic, even one of violent assault more palatable than the one she came to Rye to confess. Obviously regretting the decision to come to Rye, she seized the opportunity to avoid talking about why she came in the first place in a rapid madness, funneling all her unhinged furor on Aunt Sister Mary, who'd walked into a trap she didn't know had been set.
"No, no, Lynette, I don't know what you're talking about. I knew you had some trouble. Johanna said the estate manager caused your father's heart attack and you were the only one home with him."
Aunt Sister Mary shook her head.
"She never. Oh, dear."
This version of a terribly struck Aunt Sister Mary, nervous and fumbling and regretful and embarrassed, certainly wasn't the Aunt Sister Mary that Auntie Liv had referred to over the years in buried comments as judgmental and hypocritical and sanctimonious. Had I allowed such a harsh judgment of Sister Mary's identity based on Auntie's carefully placed words? Auntie Liv cut her off.
her working eye as bugged as the patch on her dead one, her face sideways.
"And what about you, Sister Mary, huh?"
She said Sister Mary in a taunting sarcasm.
"What about what you hide? Did you think I wasn't here the week before they kicked you out of the church? Did you think I didn't know you were hiding out in the coach house? And guess what?"
I had never heard any of this. "Auntie," I said, trying to stop her. I had an immediate urge to protect Aunt Sister Mary, an urge I had never in all my life felt before. I could tell by Sister Mary's nervous fingers under the table beside me, she hadn't intended to shock or judge or taunt Auntie Liv. She'd just wanted to give her an old pin. Maybe she'd even wanted to bridge some connection with her. But Auntie Liv took her handing the pin as an intentional aggression, or at least this was how she acted about it.
"Guess what?" Auntie Liv said, ignoring my interruption, still staring at Aunt Sister Mary.
"I saw the man enter the brick house. Yeah, sure did. A week before you, what are we calling it, huh? Left the rectory. And I heard your screams and..."
Auntie Liv stopped talking when my father turned toward the table. We all held our breaths. My father's stature is imposing. At 6'5", with still black hair and ice blue eyes on ghost white skin, when he lifts one eye at you and doesn't speak nor smile, it seems he's shriveling your soul by gaze alone, like a modern vampire. But he smiled at something above our heads and turned away, saying to Manny it was true how the sunset matched the Knicks' team colors. He'd only been confirming which NBA team sponsored the sunset. Safe again, but apparently willing to stop spilling Aunt Mary's secret, Auntie said in leaning back,
"Fuck off, Mary. Okay? Fuck you for throwing my past in my face."
She didn't wipe away the spit that flew from her broken teeth upon both utterances of fuck. And on the second utterance, she threw the pin in Aunt Sister Mary's face. Auntie Liv told my ex-nun aunt to fuck off and threw a metal pin of California in her face 1 week ago while our house chef pulled a bubbling pizza out of a rooftop oven in Rye. I didn't know how to process any of this drama. The crimes, the secrets, the total freakish oddness. My grief for my mother. It grew again.
"Mom, what would you do?
You'd know what to do.
I need you, Mom. I miss you so much."
All I could think to do was escape and drive to my Rye fort, sit in the false necropolis, and call the sea to bring me my mother. But I didn't. No. A tingle of fight came into me. I wish it had been a wash. A full swell of strength to fight off the fog. But it was something, a tingling of a coming to life. I fought off the wish to sit in my dark necropolis. I stared at Manny's back as a way to hook onto something. He still roamed the roof's edge, skirting around the potted cypress and boxwoods, surveying the Rye lawns on where to put a bullfrog pond, and discussing some other inaudible topic with my father. Perhaps he felt my visual pleas on his back, for he turned around with the biggest smile.
"Mop, how about this? Your father and I were thinking that maybe we go to the Grand Chesterton this week, relax before grad school starts, and maybe, how about we start planning the wedding to take place there?"
The Grand Chesterton is one of Manny's family resorts in Cape Cod. He looked so excited in that moment on the roof. He had no clue the amount of horror at the table between my aunts and me. And as if I were the type of girl whose thoughts could course-correct at the offer of a trip to a grand resort, I projected the most duplicitous agreement.
"Sounds great," I called back. When he turned again in a glass-clinking cheer with my likewise thrilled father, how sweet in retrospect. I turned evil eyes on Auntie Liv. A definite betrayal of Auntie in favor of Aunt Sister Mary, an act I never before considered.
"You're being rude, Auntie,"
I said in a wicked, low-hiss warning.
"When I get back from the Cape, perhaps we'll discuss other secrets."
"Hmm?" Popover would have been so proud at my delicious, disdainful purr. Auntie Liv pulled back, arms crossed. I leaned forward over the table. Aunt Sister Mary, beside me, clasped her wine glass to her chest.
"Oh, huh,"
I mocked in a cheerful lightness while leaning back. "Let's just enjoy the night. No reason to get upset over misunderstandings over old blood," I said, looking at Aunt Sister Mary in lightness. And in darkness, I turned to Auntie to add, "It's not like we have literal skeletons in our closets. Right, Auntie?" I winked at her and smiled. I did not blink, letting her know I meant every single word. Auntie ground her teeth and smiled without breaking her lips. "Something about old blood and skeletons. They never really go away."
Chapter 16, Auntie. 1 week ago. I'm driving home from that disaster of a dinner in Rye. The pizza, I didn't eat more than 3 bites of one slice. I didn't say any of the things I'd driven all the way over there to say. I couldn't. I wish I'd never gone. But Mop knows everything anyway. She made that abundantly clear, and I already knew she knew. Before leaving my house, I found her damn journal in the barn with her. And I found Johanna's orange necklace in the basement by the bones. I put the necklace back on the bitch in the barn as a reminder to be kind and not kill her. Oh, Mop knows all right. But does she know everything? No. If she did, she wouldn't be eating pizza in Rye, pitching me shit. No doubt, though, for sure my jig is up. And Sister Mary with the fucking pin. The fucking pin. How dare she? I didn't work this hard for 30 years to forget that night. Consume myself in other mental consumptions. No. I didn't work this hard for 2 years to be thrown in jail. I won't rot in jail. I will retain control of my body and direct the thoughts of my mind, dead or alive. I'm going to finish digging a 2-person pit behind the barn. I'll take care of things. Mop returns from the Cape in about a week. I'm ready. I'm not going to jail. Chapter 17, Auntie. 2 years ago. I just found Kent's bathtub filled with blood. I just found Kent's bathtub filled with blood. I vomited. I flushed. I just found Kent's bathtub filled with blood. Johanna won't pick up her phone. Fucking Route I-28 traffic and the fucking construction for the fucking new Whole Foods slows me the fuck down. I can't get to wherever the fuck Johanna is fast enough. Is she safe at the Bennington Hotel in Gloucester? I can't get a hold of Johanna. I even tried calling Kent's cell. First time ever. Nothing. What a dumbass. Of course, I should call the Bennington. 411 patches me in. Hello, Johanna Vandenbeer's room, please. Oh, hold on. Motherfucker, hurry the fuck up. I'm sorry, ma'am. No one here named Vandenbeer. I choke. My face boils. I hang up. I should ask this slack-jaw receptionist a million questions to test him, to see if Johanna is there like she said. But my throat is stuffed with gray cotton. I can't speak. Just like it felt, this feeling again. No. Just like when Daddy collapsed and I shivered alone, hiding in the basement chamber. No, stop. Don't go catatonic. Drive. Focus on the road. I should call 911. I should get help. But I need to get to Johanna. And I don't know what Kate did with my vials. Will she frame me? Somewhere along this drive, I lost track of where I am. I'm confused. I don't know where I am. I don't know where I fucking am. Where the fuck am I? I've never seen that tree before. There's exit 14. Oh, you're closer now. Relax. I'm a nurse. I'm a nurse. I'm a nurse. Stop this panic. Breathe. Get to Johanna. And then call the cops. I look at my phone and realize I failed to check a blinking fact, a voicemail. How could you not check the voicemail, you idiot? Idiot! Siri, play voicemail. Playing voicemail. Play the fucking voicemail. Siri says, Message 1 from Jojo, 8:49 p.m. Then comes Johanna's high, happy voice. Sugar cheese! No rooms at the Bennington, can you believe it? Now just relax. It's all going to be fine. I'll meet you back at the house. 8:49. An hour and a half ago. Oh, my God. I went catatonic at Kent's. No, not again. I'm going to lose again because I'm so weak. How long was I out? Where? In the bathroom, transfixed on the bathtub of blood? In the hall, when the light vines choked me? Oh, no. Drive the fucking car. Whipping off the highway, around curves and turns, uphills, downhills, tight country roads, past Annisquam, the beaches on my left, I gain closer to my home at Haddock Point State Park. Who leaves a bathtub full of blood and a drip from the faucet to ping it, making a circle of pink where water meets blood? Who does that? Who does that? Who would be so skilled to drain a body the right way, from the right cuts, and not leave a whole house of blood? A nurse. Kate is a nurse. Kate drained a body of blood. Oh, God. Here comes the gray cotton in my mouth and eyes again, my heart out of my ribs again, like when the estate manager burst into the coach house in Rye, like when he held me at knife point and ripped off my pants. Like when he pressed his little metal button in my mouth and told me to bite down with my teeth and hold it tight or it would fall into my throat and I'd choke. The taste of that metal is what it was, but in memory it tastes of gray cotton, like now. So I spit. Gray cotton in my mouth again. Like when Daddy burst in and whacked the estate manager with a metal statue, fought him off me. Like when Daddy dropped to the floor, clutching his chest. Like when Daddy lay dying on the floor, and I panicked, and I couldn't breathe, and I ran and hid in the chamber in the basement, and I couldn't move, and snot dripped into my mouth, tasting of more gray cotton, and I couldn't crawl out to lift the phone and call 911. Like when I caused my father's death. Like when my first baby died, and they did the DNC to scrape away remains, and I panicked and couldn't breathe. Thought my baby cried to me from a jar on the sink. And the second time, too, the second loss the same. And then I discovered Sister Mary had an easiness she didn't deserve. Then, too, gray cotton, too. My lost babies cried to me for help. My father, my babies. And I panicked. My heart pumping like a speeding car, my breath as shallow as a fast wind, whipping across flat ice, unable to breach the barrier of cotton in my throat, like whooshing and sweat and beating and no traction. I'm panicking. I lose control of the car. I'm skidding, a foot from the guardrail. I jerk the wheel to straight. Too far. I'm heading into the oncoming headlights of a pickup truck. I jerk back. There is no air in this car, only hot cement. I haven't breathed a full minute. My forehead is filled with hot lava and spinning, separate from the rest of my hot face. I'm straight on the road, huffing, gagging. I'm so out of control. I pass my driveway, slam on the brakes, U-turn in a burning skid, speed up my driveway. All the lights in my Rose House are on, every single light, from finished attic to second floor to first floor to basement. All the lights in the cottage are on. All the lights in my barn are on. My property is ablaze in light. My blue front door is wide open. Johanna's convertible has the front spot in my driveway, closest the barn. Kent's gray Jeep is parked behind hers. Johanna! I scream as I open my Audi door at the same time as jamming the gear to park. I'm running for the front door, following a trail of lit tea lights, which start on my front stoop. Who left a trail of tea lights? Following through my foyer, the tea lights go up my front stairs to the second floor. I ignore what could be in the kitchen or elsewhere. I follow the tea lights, the trail leading me. I'm screaming for Johanna! No one returns my calls. At the top of the stairs, I'm in my second floor hallway, and the tea lights go down my hall, past my bedroom, and around the corner to the foot of the L of these upper halls. I follow. I turn the corner. At the end of this hall is a doorway to the finished attic, and on the right, about midway, is the door to Mop's bedroom. Oh, God! Where's Mop? She's at college. Not home until next week. Johanna! I'm screaming. Johanna! Nothing. Mop has always yelled to me from this room, Auntie! Auntie! In her sweet voice. Used to be for hugs or cups of cold water or to read her another book when she was little. And now, in recent years, it's, Auntie! Auntie! Nighty-night! Love you! Acting like a little girl as our comfort routine. No Auntie Auntie meets me back. No one returns my yelling. Johanna! A quick flash of fur races past me, low to the floor. I paced myself to the hall wall, frightened. It's Popover, hurrying, now disappeared into Mop's room. Following the same path of delights I'm following, Popover is escaping something. What? I run down the second hall to Mop's room, to the spot in front of her door where the tea lights end. I turn to face the same room Popover entered, Mop's closet, Mop's room. Popover's back is high-arched. He's hissing at me from under Mop's desk. And once again tonight, I'm suffering the disabling, distorting panic I've suffered at times in my life. I'm on an Arctic glacier with gray cotton in my throat, in my lungs, and I'm sure this time it will never clear. In skating on the glacier to the interior of the room, I breathe not. I see not. I am blinded by this vision. I scrape the clouds away the second time tonight, clawing at the thick air before me as if rungs will appear. In one blink, I take the vision in, before fainting to the floor and folding into gray clouds. Kent is laid out on top of the covers as a corpse. His throat and wrists are cleanly sliced, and I presume these wounds are where Kate bled him. And now his lifeless body lies on Mop's bed. He's clothed in a herringbone wool suit, one perfect for a man at his own funeral. His arms are crossed at his waist. His legs are straight. He wears black shoes and black socks. Kate must have worked very hard to drain every drop into the tub and not spill elsewhere in their house. To be able to run only a mop in one straight line along the upper hall and down the stairs. Unless there was other cleaning I didn't see. Only a sick, twisted person would do such a thing. And I suspect with him here and the cleanliness of her crime, she aims to frame me. The tub of blood, a psychotic's tub I'm sure she plans to drain and bleach as soon as she's done with me. What is she going to do to me? What has she done to Johanna? Johanna, I croak out as I come to the moldy clouds on the floor of Mop's room at the foot of her bed where Kent lies dead. I have to fight this time. I can't grow silent and paralyzed again. Save Johanna! The only thing to ever keep me out of gray clouds is when I'm clinical. A nurse. I am a nurse. I am a nurse. I hear singing in my kitchen. I am a nurse. Go be a nurse.
Chapter 18, Auntie. 2 years ago. Some other part of me is driving my body, stumbling backward out of Mop's bedroom with Kent Drainel dead in her bed, drained of blood, his throat and wrists slit, lying there in the bright of the light of the room at the end of a trail of tea lights to make some psychotic point. I can't breathe.
What? Where is Johanna? Oh my God. Oh my God. Go. Run to the cottage. Get Johanna, who's singing in the kitchen. My active thoughts and my physical condition are in a riotous turmoil. There's a dichotomy inside me. On the one side, my executive function is driving my actions and narrating to myself what's happening. The other side is pure panic. Perhaps this is the inner split of how those in shock operate, or a soldier in war is able to walk 10 miles in desert sand with the head of a comrade in his hands so as not to leave his brother behind. It's like I'm a computer with 2 hard drives, one malfunctioning, smoking out of the disk mouth, the other running rote C commands for digitized navigation. My mind is split. My brain is splitting. I grab my skull with 2 hands, squeeze in, try to stop the white-hot pulse. Tripping, feet tied together, I will fall now. Untie my feet. The air is not air. Air, cement. My neck is swallowing my face. Push down. Push neck down from face. My legs are not tied, but I fall. I'm on the floor, my right leg bruised from hitting the bedpost. Or is the bruise from when I punched myself while driving? I reach for my neck. It is not swallowing my face. I am a nurse. I'm hyperventilating. I close my eyes, inhale through my nose. I am a nurse. I calm my rhythm with a count. 1, 2, 3. Johanna! Oh, God! Noise in the kitchen. Bang! Johanna! The pain on my right thigh is a sharp 8 on the pain scale, a cup-size welt swelling. The hematoma will be black and purple for a good 2 or 3 weeks. I am a nurse. I must pull myself to standing and inhale. 2 simple steps, stand and inhale. Johanna! Johanna! Where are my feet? Look there! Popover cowers in the corner. Popover! Popover! Go get Johanna! Johanna! I'm screaming. I believe. I am a nurse. Stand. I stand. Kent Dranel is dead in Mop's bed. This is death. I am a nurse. The walls of the bedroom and the hall walls can serve as brace supports for my feet, which are weak and not working. I believe the 8-sharp hematoma on my right leg is not the cause. The cause is my brain malfunctioning in shock. I use the walls to guide me to the stairs, and it is now, this moment, midway down the stairs, when I see a change in the foyer. The change leads through the main first-floor hall to the kitchen, where I heard a bang above the continued singing. My legs are built of liquid muscles and rubber bands. I catch myself on every tread in my descent. Johanna, 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 Johanna! My head filled with bees, bees! The lights in the foyer down the hall. To Johanna, 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 Johanna! I'm inhaling through quick breaths through my open mouth, my throat drawing sips of air, not allowing them to fall to my lungs or rise to my brain. I don't exhale. I'm a nurse. I must exhale. I must then inhale through my nostrils to feed oxygen to my brain. I pause to perform this biological need on the last tread. I take a second to appreciate the change in the foyer and hall. Starting at the midpoint of the entrance marble is a line of tea lights, and next to each tea light is a vial of pentobarbital. Are these my vials? Stolen last night? I reach the foyer and look into the kitchen, only to see shadows moving beyond the doorway. The light is a moonglow amber, the effect I created by buying the right light bulbs. I wanted my night kitchen alive against the darkness outside. It should feel like a gold glow, and the flowers beyond my kitchen window should be lit by the soft shoulders, so I can watch the swooping bats beyond the blue tangle of morning glories, which crawl beside the window boxes of hot pink petunias. But it is no longer a gold glow. This now is a blinding surgical light with new meaning. Johanna, 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 Johanna! Don't say her name. Walk slow. Then it won't be her at the end of the line of pento vials. Does say her name and walk slow. My neck is choking me. Johanna! Beyond where I can see, I believe from somewhere near my kitchen table, a woman's voice hums Simon and Garfunkel's America. I know the lyrics like I know the range of dangerous blood pressure in correlation to ranges of body mass index. Johanna listens and hums this song constantly, like it's her breath. If you ever catch Johanna unaware, perhaps if you sneak up to spy on her working away at her fashion blog, or her arranging her sea glass into shapes, you can stand behind her a full 10 minutes, watching her work away, and listen to her happy humming of the carousel rhythm of America. And this is exactly what the woman's voice does now in my kitchen, but the voice is not Johanna's. Whoever this woman is, she's mocking Johanna. She must have been watching Johanna to know her song. I am a nurse. I make quick deductions. I am a nurse. I must step to the kitchen and confirm my theory. Johanna, my love, Johanna. My eyes are blind. What is this light flickering in my eyes? What is this blood dripping down my thighs? She sings your song, Johanna. Did you teach her today? Is that what this is? Is she your friend? And you taught her to sing your song, Johanna? I'm crying. I cannot help it. I'm weeping to hear someone else pretend to be the voice of my beloved Johanna. My mental sides are mixing together, the hard drives of me both malfunctioning. No, no, no. Think. I am a nurse. You are a nurse. Blood is not dripping down my legs. There is no liquid dripping down my legs. I refuse to believe there is blood on my legs. My legs are liquid. I pause. I inhale. I pause. I inhale. I am a nurse. My legs are not liquid. I inhale through my nose, which is clogged with emotion and phlegm. Viscous is my interior and exterior. My feet are crumbling meat, my legs still rubber. The walls of the hall are a savior for me. I scratch at the wallpaper as if I can reach into the vines and the red and blue birds for traction and catch. My stomach and breasts are pressed flat against flat birds and vines, and I slide along my own hall like a shadow creature so as to avoid touching the toxic trail of vials and tea lights. I reach the kitchen. I am standing in the entrance to my kitchen. Where am I? How did I get here? Who is here? What am I seeing? I am blind in the light and the gray clouds. I am not blind. I am a nurse. I am not blind. I'm just not believing. I am standing in the entrance to my kitchen, my yellow-lit kitchen. I am standing in the entrance to my kitchen. I am looking to my right at the humming Kate Drainel, who sits at my kitchen table. She is folding my underwear in three folds, picking each piece from my green laundry basket. Kate shouts at me as some grand greeting, wild-eyed with a savage smile. Her humming is a violent humming version of America. She's sitting in my blue-painted chair, my chair. She's sitting at my table in my chair, wearing a navy and light blue ball gown. There are a few twigs in her hair, scratches on her melting pink-rouged cheeks, like she applied clown blush and then shoved her face in a bush hard and fast, back and forth, raping twigs with her mouth and cheeks. Her ill-advised CVS brand black eyeliner, which she drew right inside the rim, like the deplorable she is, droops low into the dry, drooping bags under her bloodshot eyes. True pink lipstick is not on her lips so much, but rather smeared around her mouth and staining her teeth. Kate is singing Johanna's song. Johanna! Yellow light stings my eyes. The windows are swirling liquefied gray clouds. Johanna, where are you? I can't look. No, I will not. No, no, Johanna. I will not look to the left of me. No,
I know you are in here, too. I don't want to see you. Johanna, stop moaning.
Dangling from Kate's finger, held aloft like E.T. pointing to home with his gold-lit finger, is my gold thong, a pair I wore for Kent Dranel on an occasion or two, or 10. One time, his teeth tore away at the lace hem around the leg holes. So anxious to arouse me, he tore the lace in two spots, leaving sagging loops away from the stitch line to the cotton and silk panel of my crotch. And yet I kept them, I confess. Does Kate know her husband's teeth made the torn loops she slips her fingers through?
Don't look to the stove to the left. Don't register the murmuring, murmuring, moaning. Don't look, don't look, don't look, don't look, don't, no. I won't listen to the gagging, don't look. She's gagging. I'm gagging. A trickle of blood teardrops down past my knee to my ankle. That is not blood. That is only sweat. Don't look down. Don't look left.
I turn my head to the left for vision of my black stove and to identify a voice from this direction. An undefined and muddled moan obstructed by something, murmuring and possibly screaming. It is indeed Johanna, and she's in an impossible contraption. She is seated on top of my black gas stove, duct-taped in place by at least an entire roll. Her legs wound in silver adhesive, her hips, too, the tape anchored around the stove. I'm a nurse. Perhaps this took two rolls. I'm a nurse. She is sitting directly atop the right front round burner, her left hip spilling onto the middle griddle where we make pancakes. Her arms are tied behind her back, her mouth duct-taped. She cries, she wails, the noises of a dying animal. The stove is not on. The stove is not on, not on. Oh, Johanna, Johanna, my Johanna, my Johanna. Here comes my neck swallowing my head. I vomit. My throat burns, bile now on my feet, which my feet do not exist. I don't have feet. There's no need to look down at the vomit to see if it met my feet because I'm feetless. It's okay. Okay, okay, okay. I cannot quit these tears. I cannot clear these clouds. Can I speak to Kate, who folds my underwear at the table? The woman who ignores my sickness on the floor, my sister on the stove, my cries, her cries? Might I speak reason to the woman who hums on, calm, in singing more about America and folding my underwear in three? Can I beg Kate Dranel to help me and help my sister, even though she is an obvious psychopath, the very cause? I stare up at Kate Dranel from my kitchen floor. I collapsed, given the absence of feeling in my feet, my hands barely missing the pile of my sickness. My feet do not exist. Blood drips down my legs. No, my legs are blood, only blood. I can't move. Johanna. Kate looks down upon me and hums. Using my arms, which prickle, turning to liquid too, I drag my torso sideways toward the stove. I'm like a limp animal, chewed free of a bear trap, legs mangled and useless. Blood is draining from my femoral artery along the kitchen floor. Get to stove. Free Johanna. I am a nurse. Blood is not draining from my femoral artery. That's a mind's split fiction. I'm not cut. My legs are freezing cold to no feeling. I cannot move them. I reach Johanna's bound legs. Kate Dranel launches herself from my kitchen table and barrels for me as I pick and pry away at duct tape in a panicked attempt to unwind Johanna. Kate's blue-on-blue gown is strapless, and I note the mottling of the skin on her arms, red blotches against the whitest of skin. She's either suffering poor circulation or unable to calibrate temperature. I'm a nurse. Or are those red blotches not red, but a rust red, like dried blood? Kate elbows my cranium, crashing me backward, landing me on my buttocks and into my open shelves, which host a collection of yellowware mixing bowls, bladders, cups, figurines, tureens, gravy boats, and plates. I hit so hard, the antique shelving unit shakes, and dozens of pieces fall and shatter to the floor. but in some miracle, miss my head. A shard slices my left hand at the fatty part between the thumb and gun barrel finger. Johanna wails from her throat.